Of course, Walter Benjamin once said, "I'd like to rewrite Capital just through quotations," but that's another story. But so what Manet is doing, a lot of very interesting social critique, but at the same time, he's using a lot of formal innovations, you know, the distorted mirror there, the way in which it's, the perspective is not right. So modernism becomes some other things. And of course, this leads us on to the first encounter between Marxism and modernism. And I'll use the writings that slightly later out of George Lukács. He was absolutely the most influential Marxist theorist of the 20s and 30s. And he says there's a real difference between realism and modernism. That realism is progressive and modernism is decadent. And the reason is that he says realism, the realists are open to history. And he uses the example of Balzac. Now Balzac, the French writer, is a royalist. He's right wing. He believes the monarchy should be back. He hates the revolution. He hates the middle classes. He thinks industrial growth is terrible, etc. But Lukács says, and Marx actually, says he's the finest critic of capitalist society. Why? Because he shows that society in all its complexity, and it's open to history. And what Lukács says is in 1848 we get a separation between realism begins to break up, and on the one hand we get naturalism, and these are maybe difficult terms, but naturalism means we just copy reality, almost like a photograph. So a photograph just takes a picture of reality. Whereas realism actually doesn't just take a picture of reality, it attempts to show how that reality is constructed. On the other side of naturalism, we get subjectivism. Lukács calls it symbolism. Subjectivism, where the world is just you. So this might be naturalism, because this is Caillebotte. We saw one of his pictures this morning. It's the new Paris, but it's a new, quite horrible Paris. It's a Paris of rational straight lines. It's a machine Paris, and everybody there is an isolated individual. There's no communication. These aren't the people. Do you remember Courbet's people, or even Repin's people? This is not people, this is the big city crowd, the alienated big city crowd. And in this naturalism, I'm using this word again here, what Lukács calls reification. Actually, we can no longer see society as a whole. We can only see either the surface or our own subjective images of it. And here's Toulouse-Lautrec, again, a brutally natural picture, the medical examination for brothels in Paris. But then we've got here the subjective. So you think of Manet, Manet's picture, there we are again, with its social critique. Here, there's no real, from this perspective, there's no real social critique. It's a nightmare. Toulouse-Lautrec is in the painting there. It's a nightmare of evil-looking men, of green, horrible-looking women. It's a subjective nightmare. There's no real social critique. So it's this idea that we go from, on one hand, photographs, on the other, pure subjective nightmare. And of course, the classic image of that is Munch's The Scream, where the whole world is reduced to one, the inside of one's head. So that was the real image of modernism among the communist parties of the 20s and 30s, that somehow this sort of art was decadent. This sort of art just showed individual suffering, but without any social explanation. It was just an individual. There's no social explanation for it. But the modernists had a different view of it. And one of the things that Andrew talked about this morning was how modernity was not just social suffering, social inequality, poverty, those sorts of things. Modernity was also a radical disruption of experience, of who we are. So we're back here with the artistic critique. Somehow, modernity destroys the soul, destroys our experience. And the only way you can deal with that experience is to constantly innovate, to change the form, to capture this new world. Because if you kept repeating the old forms, the traditional forms, then you would just fall into the trap of the world. You would just be part of the machine. You had to keep looking again, you know, keep looking again, be clear and clear, look again, change the form, look again at what was happening in the world. So there was a sense that we have to have different forms in order to describe the world. And as the world got crazier and crazier, as modernity went faster and faster, traditional artistic forms, the traditional forms of realism, were not possible. So how, this is a picture of society, the rich, the poor, the clergy, the important people. There it is in the picture. But how do you show a modern world? How do you show the whole of a city? It's just not possible to present it from one point of view. It's not according to the modernists. You can only see glimpses, aspects of it. If you ever read James Joyce's Ulysses, you'll see what the attempt to describe a city in a modernist way. Not only that, so tradition was no longer, certainly after 1918, tradition was no longer a guide. And so I've got three kinds of modernisms that come out of that. The first is what we might call high modernism. And this is that in this world that's completely destroyed, in this world where tradition has disappeared, where rationalization has taken over, art should withdraw into itself. It's sort of like art for art's sake, but a modernist version. So we get people like T.S. Eliot. I don't know if you know him, he wrote a very famous poem called The Wasteland, where he says modern world is a spiritual wasteland, and he finds a way within the poetry itself to somehow find some meaning. Or musicians like Stravinsky, who after writing a very explosive piece of music in 1913, after the war, he goes back to classical tradition. He says, I don't write about any, I just do pure music, pure form. Or you get Yeats, the Irish poet, who was very much involved in Irish revolutionary politics at one point, but in 1920s and 30s, he writes a very famous poem where he says, I'm sailing to Byzantium. I'm leaving for this world, for an artificial world. Byzantium is Constantinople, you know. And of course, we've got the person Andrew talked about this morning in a very different context in America, Greenberg's modernist formalism. But there are other modernisms. There are these, what I might call voices from the fragments, the artists who attempt to find meaning in the world. So the work of Marcel Proust, James Joyce, Kafka, Alfred Doblin, that somehow authentic experience is possible, but only in fragments, and only in the fragmented work of art. So they reject bourgeois aesthetics through a kind of modernist aesthetics. And these are the people that are liked by the Marxist theoreticians like Walter Benjamin and Ernst Bloch and Brecht a bit later, and Adorno after them. But we have a third kind of Marxism, third kind of modernism, which very much is attracted by Marxism in the 1920s. And Andrew called it the avant-garde tradition, and I'll call it the same. Very much about, we've got to destroy the old world and bring in this new world. And as Bertolt Brecht says, who is probably the greatest Marxist playwright of the 20th century, says, let's start from the bad new days, not the good old days. That's where we've got to start. And they embrace popular culture. They embrace film, they embrace the musical, they embrace cabaret, they embrace radio, all these forms of popular culture which are just for setting out, great, let's have them. They're not interested in being artists. Brecht writes an essay called The Artist as Producer. We've just got to get it out there. Never mind being the artist starving and the sensitive, get it out there. Must publish, must do something. So it embraces popular culture, it embraces technology. And the great theorist of this is Walter Benjamin, and he wrote an essay about the work of art in this age of mechanical reproduction. But they also embrace modernity, as Andrew said, a kind of modernity. The new architecture, the roads, the factories, the new department stores, the massive, the crowds of the street. This is great, this is modernity. Our question is not to say, oh, how horrible this is, how terrible modern world is. It's, this is great, let's make it a good world. And they embrace American, is what they call Americanism, the skyscrapers, you know, the popular culture. And they said, well, we can do it better than them. So you look at German architecture and Russian architecture and, as well, East European architecture. And they say, we can do it better than America because we believe in socialism. And there's this great dialogue between American and European modernism, where American is seen as just capitalist modernity, whereas us in Europe can do socialist modernity. And this debate is only just coming back in. It's something I'll talk about in the next days, but it's only just coming back in, this sense of a modernism that embraces modernity but also socialism. But of course the classic example of that is the Russian avant-garde in the 1920s. Russian avant-garde became the most advanced of the avant-garde in the 1920s, but it also saw itself as part of the revolution. And for 10 years, the new communist state in Russia and the avant-garde, the left-wing artists, worked together. So this is Malevich's Red Cavalry. You can see it's got cavalry somewhere on the horizon, you know, the Red Cavalry. These are the horse. It is clearer. These are horse people on horses. You know, the Red Guard, the Red Cavalry. But it's an abstract painting. It's not realist. And of course, this. Well, let's see some other examples. We've got, this is a very famous one. Maybe you've seen this one. This is 1919. El Letizzi, beat the whites with the red wedge. Completely political. It's obvious what it's about. It's about the Civil War, it's about the Red Army beating the counter-revolutionary whites, expressed in absolutely abstract form. Not just the paintings, but also street culture was transformed. So this is one of my favourite. This is new kind of language. And they were serious. How do you speak to the masses? How do you speak visually to the masses? And they thought, we can invent a new language to do that. A pure language, a modern language, nothing to do with tradition, nothing to do with the past, nothing to do with bourgeois aesthetics, but a new language. So it was a very ambitious project. But in fact, in 1934, it happened before then, probably in 1928, in 1934, officially, modernism is decadent. And that also happened in China. And I would say in Russia from 1934 till the 1980s, similarly in China, modernist art is seen as somehow bourgeois, decadent, anti-revolution, anti-party. And I think that's something that's being reopened now. But why did it reject modernism? Why? I mean, they wanted to be part of the revolution. Why reject it? Well, first of all, the idea that the leading role of the proletariat. Remember what I talked about, the idea that somehow art is for the intellectuals and social justice is for the workers. Well, then in which case is the workers in a workers' state that should take the lead role? So art should, you know, this new art developed by these middle-class intellectuals, why should we listen to that? It's the proletariat and their view that should count. So proletarian, in those days, tend to be, often there were peasants in Russia, they wanted pictures. They wanted pictures of people on horses. They didn't want all that. They didn't want to look at that. They wanted pictures. They wanted repping, the leading role of the party. One of the principles of modernism was that art should be set its own rules. It should be a new set of rules in the service of the revolution. But the party said, no, we represent the revolution. So there's a big conflict between the party and the autonomy of art. And this was a real conflict, I think, at the heart of some of their relationships. And I think it develops into a big division then between Western Marxism and Eastern, let's say, actually existing communism. Because once the Russian and Chinese revolutions rejected the autonomy of art, then it begins that Western Marxism begins to separate. And I'll say something about that now. So we get, by the 1940s and 1950s, we get this separation between Eastern Marxism and Western Marxism. And it's not just about ideology, because one of the claims of Western Marxism is that culture is important because that's what controls people's minds and we need to engage with that. But it's also about this need for the artistic critique of capitalism. The idea that one part of the revolution has got to be about self-realization, about fulfillment. Trip, we're back at 1968. We're back at 1968 with the new left that discovers modernism again after it being thrown in the bin, pushed to one side. It brings left modernism back. We get the rise of popular culture, but not popular culture like Hollywood, but popular culture like rock music. So the art colleges produced a new kind of popular music. And in fact, one of the things we can see about popular music or popular culture in the West is this mixing of modernism and popular culture. And out of that, we get a new kind of radical aesthetic. So, and I'm going to talk more about this when I talk about the cultural industries, because this is where the cultural industries come from, because it's from the 1960s that people say, well, everybody should produce culture. Everybody should be an artist. Everybody has the right to engage in cultural production. And so what we find in 1960s is a new kind of radical aesthetics. We get, from the 1960s, we get an attack on art, both academic and in among academics and artists. They begin to attack this old idea of bourgeois art. They attack the idea that there's a national culture that art expresses, that there's one kind of national culture. That they say there's multiple, there's many kinds of cultures. We're not just one national culture. They also say we're not just one kind of person. So there's a rejection of this identity that is expressed by art. They also say that this separation between art and life, you know, art goes in the museum, art goes in the theatres, and then there's everyday life. They also say, no, we've got to bring art and life together. Again, it's a theme of radical modernism from the 1930s. And we get what somebody in the 1980s called the aestheticisation of everyday life. Now, in the 80s, everybody wants to be, their everyday life has become aesthetic. Somebody else, who I'll talk about these two things next week, somebody else talks about the culturalisation of the economy. That the economy itself is driven by culture. Our lives are driven by aesthetics now, and the economy is driven by culture. What do they mean by that? So, going back to my original question, this is my last slide, I think. No, last slide, but oh yeah, last slide. Has the artistic critique of capitalism got rid of that social critique, as Baltansky and Schapelo say? Has the social critique been abandoned in favour of aesthetic fulfilment? Do we all just indulge ourselves through culture and consumption at the expense of any wider political or ethical concerns? What kind of aesthetic fulfilment? Is shopping or developing a lifestyle, is that the victory of aesthetics? Is it this victory of self-fulfillment and creativity? And of course, now, aesthetics are not opposed to economics. Traditionally, right the way back, aesthetics was a solution or an antidote. It's a space, nothing to do with the market, nothing to do with the economics. Now, the aesthetics drives the economy. So if that's the case, we live in a cultural economy. Where's politics? Where's ethics? And of course, without politics and without ethics, there's no Marxism, but there's no political ideology at all. So are we living in a completely depoliticized world of aesthetic consumption? Or might we see something slightly differently emerging? And with those big questions, I will leave you.